I'm Earlonne Woods.
I'm Nigel Poor. We're the hosts and creators of Ear Hustle from PRX's Radiotopia.
Ear Hustle is a show about life inside prison, but it's not your typical prison podcast.
In this next season, we've got stories about the objects people keep inside their prison cells.
About residents in a women's prison who say they want to stay there.
And the most beautiful prison garden. Earlonne, I will never forget it.
Ear Hustle. Stories about life on the inside, told by those who live it.
Find Ear Hustle wherever you get your podcasts.
Support for WABE's local coverage on maternal health and mortality comes from Georgia Health Initiative, whose mission is to inspire and promote collective action that advances health equity for all Georgians. Learn more at GeorgiaHealthInitiative.org.
So, what's on the political breakfast menu this week? I'm Dennis O'Hare, and I'll be your host with opinions from the left and from the right. And we've got some specials today. Georgia's two Republican senators responded very differently from each other to President Trump's reported comments about Haiti and African nations. We'll look at how the president is faring here in Georgia in the polls 1 year into his term. The Georgia governor's race, meanwhile, is heating up on the Democratic side. Atlanta's new mayor comes into office and reaches a peace deal with the city's school system. And this week's winter weather strangled operations at Hartsfield-Jackson International Airport. What that means after a rough year for the world's busiest airport. So pull up a seat at the table. It's the inaugural episode of our podcast. And with us today, Republican Brian Robinson and Democrat Theron Johnson.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. Glad to be back.
We have to start with the president's remarks about African nations and Senator David Perdue's response, which evolved over time. Brian, it seems logically that if he was going to say, I was in the room and the president didn't say that, he should have said that first instead of saying, well, I don't recall, and then saying he didn't say it.
The sequencing of the messaging was not ideal, I will say. But one thing that is consistent is he didn't hear the president say that. The president says that is not the word that he used.
But was there another profanity that he used? There was a little parsing among some of the reports anyway about whether he said bleep hole or bleep house. Or, I can't even believe I'm saying these things.
I'm not that upset if he did say it. I don't think that a lot of Americans in reality are that upset. I don't think anybody thinks that no curse words were ever used in offensive ways in Democratic administrations.
But is it the profanity or the application to other nations and groups of people?
It is to other nations. He did not single out groups of people. He is talking about nations. When you talk about nations, it cannot be racist. I completely reject that. He is talking about economic development. He is talking about levels of education. He is talking about governance and human rights, things that don't exist in the nations that he mentioned. I think anybody, by any objective standard, could say, hey, I'm not going to plant up from my house here in Sandy Springs and move to El Salvador and open a business. Why? Because there's bad governance there. Because there's not rule of law in countries like that. There's not clean water, for goodness sake. He's absolutely right.
But then why deny, as Senator Perdue and Senator Cotton did, why even deny he said it?
I wouldn't deny it. I would go out there and say, yeah, Americans have the right to determine our immigration laws. We have the right to determine what kind of workforce we need, what kind of level of education we're going to require for immigration, what level of English skills we're going to require. There's nothing scandalous about that. This is a rational policy view. And let me say, it also is reflective of what he promised Americans as candidate Trump. He is keeping his promises.
Let's just start with Senator Perdue. He represents a wing of the Republican Party that no matter what this president says or does, he's going to be committed to being loyal to him. Then there's another sector of the Republican Party that I think Senator Isaacson represents, which is the more sensible portion of the party, who knows that this president is unhinged and that he has consistently made racist comments that therefore allow people to think that he is a racist. The fact that we want to have an argument about whether a president in a Oval Office used the word asshole is the problem that we have with this country. He is the president of the United States of America. He should not be referring to any continent, any country, any human being, and using that type of language in a public meeting. And so I truly believe this, and I want to go on the record for saying this, is that this is not the first time that we've had this conversation. And I'm not so even mad at David Perdue trying to defend the president, because that's what he's supposed to do. He has made it very clear that he's going to be loyal. And I'm not even mad that Johnny Isaacson decided to send out a tweet that was very forceful, saying that if the president said this, he should be ashamed of himself. I want to judge these two Republican senators who will go to Ebenezer Church, sit in the pulpit, who will go out here and give us some symbolic gestures to the African-American community. Where are they going to do about this president? It's okay to send out a tweet. It's okay to go on national news and say you don't recall. But what are you going to do to heal this country? And therein lies my problem with these two U.S. senators. And it's what Dr. King said. It's not what bad people do in these type of situations, but it's when good people grow silent. I feel like we have too many people around this state that won't call these two senators out and won't call this president out. President Alpha, who he truly is, and that is that he is a person that is trying to divide this country, and he's very consistently racist remarks towards people of color.
Question coming from that, and Theron, I'm going to start with you on this one. Theoretically, Democrats should be energized by this. Senator Perdue is up for re-election in just over 2 years, in November of 2020. But do Democrats have the bench to seize an issue like this on which they could reach out to all sorts of voters and challenge a very strong, well-funded incumbent?
Well, let's make it very clear. Senator Perdue will not have a problem in his primary. I think that he's revered here in Georgia, and the Republicans have always been very smart to not challenge an incumbent. The problem with Democrats is that we can't keep telling people that Trump is this bigot and this racist of who he shows that he is every single day to us. We cannot continue to tell the American people that. What we've got to do is that we've got to refocus on expanding Medicaid. We got to talk about job creation. At a time, Dennis, where 34 state reps and state senators have lost their seats across the country since Donald Trump was inaugurated, is a good sign for Democrats. And what we've got also is highlight on some of the local races that we've been able to win across the state. Now, in order for us to really pose a really unified challenger,
Senate race is a whole different thing.
So what we got to do is figure out, how do we focus on what's ahead of us, which is the governor's race, lieutenant governor's race, and all the constitutional officers? And also we have some congressional races as well.
Yeah, you have a little business this year.
Right. But I think that once we get past that, whoever doesn't succeed in the governor's race, I do think we have a great host of legislators, people like Teresa Tomlinson down in Columbus, former mayor of Columbus, I think is eyeing a U.S. Senate race. But more importantly, I think that we got to continue to condition the minds of voters in Georgia.
Brian, you wanted to respond to some of what Theron had to say, but also there's that question now, does this affect Senator Perdue?
Well, I think we need to focus on this cycle first. So it's impossible to say how this is going to impact David Perdue's electoral chances. We don't know what Donald Trump's standing is going to be in the year on which he is in the ballot as well as the incumbent president. Senator Perdue has made his bed. We've discussed this many times. He is an ardent Trump loyalist, and he was a loyalist before anybody thought that was a good political idea. And David Perdue has been one step ahead of all of us on that. His instincts and his team's instincts have proven to be right time and time again. So for now, let's give them and their political choices the benefit of the doubt, because they've been winning, and they've been right on where Americans were going to be. But as far as the president using names, look, the breathlessness with which the mainstream media has approached this, from the New York Times to CNN on down, is flooring to me. There was a huge difference between what he said and Hillary Clinton's basket of deplorables, who were actually, she was referring to actual Americans, and to President Obama talking about people of faith being bitter gun clingers.
Well, President Trump, in that infamous Billy Bush tape, was talking about women. You can cite—
And he won the election 10 days later, or whatever it was. Americans didn't care. So I have a hard time believing that in the wash of news that comes over us every day from the Trump administration, that this is going to be a huge contretemps for a period of time. It's not. We're going to move on fairly quickly, and this will be forgotten. But what's important is the underlying policy issue. And in many ways, he's right. He is being true to who he is as a candidate and as president. And it also is in line with what Senator Perdue and Senator Cotton of Arkansas are trying to accomplish, which is move to a merit-based immigration system that stops chain migration, that's good policy and good for this country.
But, Brian, are there warning signs, though, not just for Senator Perdue, but for President Trump here in Georgia? He has been able to hold his popular approval rating for a while, but now a new AJC poll shows, things are starting to erode a little bit.
Absolutely, Dennis. And I think even my good Democrat friend Theron will back me up when I say I have warned about this for 3 years now, that electorally we may get short-term gains, but at the sacrifice of long-term losses. Right now, on the generic ballot for Congress, we are 10 points down. Republicans are 10 points down to Democrats. So that means you call Americans across the country and they say, if the election were held today, would you vote for a Republican or a Democrat for Congress? That's what generic ballot means. Mm-hmm. There's no name attached where there might be an incumbent advantage. And a 10-point advantage is massive, even with the redistricting advantage that Republicans built in 2011 during that redistricting period. So we are in a lot of trouble, and Theron's right. I mean, just this week, we had a special election loss in a solidly Republican district in Wisconsin in a state Senate race, and you're seeing that all over the Midwest particularly. And you saw in Georgia, even in two Athens area-based House districts in special elections in late last year, Republicans have held those with no opposition for many years, and Democrats picked up both of them by fairly healthy margins. We have a problem, and we have got to get smarter, and the president has got to stay on message and become more disciplined and get things done. It's like Senator McConnell said this week, I'll move forward on a bill when I know what the president is for. I don't know yet. That's a problem, and that's on President Trump's lap, and he's got to get better.
See, the problem we have is that we have Republicans in this state who, behind closed doors, when they're not on radio or TV or on a podcast, they'll say exactly what I say about Donald Trump, which is that he's destructive and morally.
Have they said it to you?
Oh, they have said it to me, but they won't say it publicly because herein lies the problem, Dennis. Donald Trump became president of the United States because white people, white working class people who benefited under the Obama administration, hated Hillary Clinton so much that they were willing to vote for Donald Trump to make him president because they felt like he would try to undo some of the good policies that President Obama put forth. And so the problem is that I think what you're seeing in Georgia is that a lot of these disaffected white Republican women are embarrassed. They are embarrassed to call Donald Trump their president. They see how he demeans people. And I think that if Georgia is falling behind, then it also means that we have an opportunity to pick up states like North Carolina and places in Florida again. And so,
but Theron, do Democrats have to do more than just tie their Republican opponents to Donald Trump?
It's a confluence because you got to remind people how bad this president is, but you also got to make the connection between how the leadership in the GOP, the Speaker, the Senate Majority Leader, they can't get anything done for American people because of this president. But then also, Dennis, we've got to tell people what we're for. We've got to make the clear distinction between what the party of Democrats represent versus the GOP. And so I think what you're going to start to see is that anyone who makes the fundamental decision to actually run the most progressive campaign and not be afraid to call Donald Trump and the GOP leadership for who they are, then I think you'll see those people start to emerge. But the problem is that we have this methodology in the state of Georgia where we feel that we've got to go and be appealing to a lot of these independent, moderate voters, which we do. But I think that the polls show that a lot of these independent voters and moderate voters in the state of Georgia are moving away from Donald Trump. Doesn't necessarily mean that they're moving to the Democratic Party. We've got to grab them and tell them what we're for and be able to win when the elections come up.
And Brian, do Republicans face a similar dilemma, only in reverse? In order to reach out and keep independent, moderate voters from going to the Democrats, do they have to divorce themselves from Donald Trump and lose the base?
Not yet. And let me just say ditto and bravo to everything that Theron just said. He's absolutely right. In Georgia, there is not a Republican majority, despite what people think. There is not a Democrat majority. There are more Republicans than there are Democrats, which is why we win. But the other reason we win is because moderates and independents say they're not aligned. They say they don't know who they're going to vote for. And traditionally, over the last four, five, six cycles in Georgia, they break to the Republican candidate in the end. And that's why Republicans control all statewide elected officials today. So we've got to maintain that slice of the electorate. It is the only way to get to 50% plus one. Now, how do we do it? Well, you're seeing Republicans on the state level, independent of Trump, talking about state issues. You're seeing David Ralston, our speaker, talk about state funding for transit. You're seeing the House and Senate looking for ways to improve the living standards in rural Georgia, adding broadband, saving rural hospitals by taking a new approach on Medicaid and coverage for indigent patients. So those are some blue-collar, little-man populist issues that aren't offensive, that aren't divisive, but there are things that Georgia Republicans are talking about that can appeal to that demographic.
Let's shift to the Democrats now for a moment. Let's talk about the Democratic race for governor. Theron, let me start with you. The last few weeks have seen Stacey Abrams go on something of a blitz. She's been on talk shows, on podcasts. She's gotten Cory Booker, senator from New Jersey, down here to campaign for her. She's opening up all sorts of offices and outreach. Is this something she can sustain, or is this kind of a preemptive strike to line up support and money quickly in what could be a really tough battle with Stacey Evans?
Stacey Abrams has realized what I realize, and that is that there's something going on in this country and there's something going on in this state. When you have Republicans finally having the courage to say, hey, I disapprove of this president. I don't approve of how he's promised us all of these things he's going to do and he hasn't been able to deliver. What she's also doing, Dennis, which is very interesting, is that she's running a non-traditional campaign, because the model in the late 90s and the early 2000s were to do as well as you can amongst people of color, particularly African-American women, but have a moderate message that appeals to white Democrats and white independents.
And she is going full-throated progressive.
But here's the thing that's interesting. Let's really dissect this word progressive. You know, during the mayor's race, I came on your show and I shamed white progressives. I said, how can you dare be a progressive and not vote for the most progressive person in the race? What she's interestingly doing, Dennis, is that she has this unique appeal to white Republicans and to white progressives. But what she does is that she talks about it from a different context. She really comes at it from the left. Most times you see Democrats in Georgia, they really try to start in the middle, and then maybe they'll waver right or a little bit left. But what Minority Leader Abrams is doing, she's saying, hey, I'm going to run this very progressive campaign from the left. I'm going to embrace all the things that people in the past have never embraced. But I wouldn't say this. Don't count Stacey Evans out. Because with Stacey,
well, no, she is a very able, very formidable candidate, right, with some endorsements of her own.
Absolutely. And she made a very key strategic decision to endorse
Keisha Lance Bottoms
at a time where, quite frankly, it was unpopular. I mean, at that time when she came out and endorsed the campaign, Brian and others thought that Mary Norwood was going to go on to be the 60th mayor. And so she came out and stood and got criticized. In my party, white Democrats all across the metro area criticized Stacey Evans for standing up for Black Girl Magic. And she said, hey, I believe in Black Girl Magic, and I believe in Atlanta Magic, and she thinks that it can be Georgia Magic. So what Evans has got to do is go beyond that. She just can't say, okay, I got the, I endorsed the African-American mayor of the city of Atlanta, but how does she really build upon her rural Georgia roots, and how does she go in places where Abrams has already opened up offices, but also I know Evans has opened up offices as well. But here's the bottom line. We're going to have a woman who's going to be running for governor of Georgia. We're definitely going to have a white man on the Republican side. It's going to be very interesting to see which white man will be able to handle this woman candidate for governor, because they've never had to do that before. And I think that what you're going to see is the time where this president continuously starts to criticize people. He continues to divide us. All of these Republicans who are running for governor are going to have to either embrace Donald Trump or they're going to have to distance themselves from him.
And Brian, how closely are strategists on your side watching what the Democrats are doing even now, and who emerges from that battle?
That's not our fight right now. Our eyes on the Republican side.
But are they watching what the kind of warning signs that Theron was talking about among the electorate possibly?
Here are the things that we're noticing from afar, because, again, we're focused on May 22nd, which is the primary date where we're fighting to get the nomination for the Republican Party. All eyes are on that. But we see the news, and that's about the end of our engagement in it. What I've seen is what Theron said, that they are racing toward the left in a way that almost assures their unelectability with those independent moderates that we were just talking about. I am so pleased that Theron is right and that this is a strategy that they are undertaking. Stacey Abrams is taking out a far-left position. And we have a majority African-American Democratic primary in this state. So she has a built-in racial identity advantage there. So she's going to be very hard to beat in a statewide race in a Democratic primary. So how does Evans compete with that? By being even more liberal. That's the only pathway for her, is to stake out even crazier ground, even more combative with Donald Trump and the Republican establishment. She's going to have to take on maybe more moderate elements of her own party to get to far enough left to take down a prominent, smart, capable African-American candidate for the Democratic nomination. So they're in a really bad spot. And I also saw this week where, and Theron alluded to this, that Stacey Abrams put out a release yesterday saying that she's opening nearly a dozen offices around the state. That is campaign malpractice. It is so irresponsible. I'm glad to see her doing it, but she might as well be rolling up money and lighting it with a torch and smoking it like a cigar, because it is going to have no impact on the ground game. It is a bad use of limited resources. And we saw in the first disclosure that Abrams had a really bad burn rate, which means she was spending too much money for how much money was coming in to the campaign. This is more evidence of irresponsible spending by a Democrat.
So,
right? You agree with me. It is burning money.
So, no, I absolutely disagree. I think if you want to have a true statewide appeal, you've got to have people in those communities. And I know that Evans is planning on opening up offices as well. But what Brian wants our listeners to believe is that his candidate and others, they're just all, you know, kissing cousins. They all are together and they're all, you know, saying, oh, we're going to be fine. His biggest challenge, that he knows this, he's got two people in the Republican primary right now. One, Senator Michael Williams, and you got Clay Tippins. And these are people who I think will bring an unorthodox approach. But the true thing is this. I think that the two Stacey's on the Democratic side, they're not both running to the left. I think Abrams is running a more progressive campaign, talking about more progressive issues. It's unfair to say that Evans is actually going to have to run more to the left in order to win a Democratic primary. The biggest misconception I think that we can make is that voters are very particular about how they feel about different candidates. And it's no shoo-in that Stacey Abrams is going to receive a really huge amount of African-Americans to support her, because we just saw in the city of Atlanta, Mary Norwood, who I truly believe is a Republican, received a fair share of the African-American vote in the city. And so I think the key between those two women is to have a very strategic argument and conversation about the issues, and don't get bogged down in some of the social and divisive issues that the Republicans want us to be talking about. But whoever emerges from the Republican side, that gentleman will be battered and bruised. It's highly likely to go to a runoff. They're going to have to spend tens of millions of dollars to beat up on one another. And so what we've got to do is that be unified and be ready to go and appeal to these voters when the general election occurs.
Speaking of the Atlanta mayor, Keisha Lance Bottoms started her administration, really her first public gesture to a constituency outside of the mayor's office, Theron, was to settle, at least for the most part, the property dispute with the Atlanta Public Schools. And we should disclose here, WABE's broadcast license is held by the Atlanta Board of Education. Well, a lot of property deeds that the city and the school board have been fighting about for ages went back to the school board.
You know, promise made and promise kept. During the campaign, she talked a lot about the deeds, and she said publicly that she would release them very soon in her administration.
And this is a departure from the stance taken by Mayor Reed.
Absolutely. And it starts the process of her gaining her independence and showing not only that she did it, but this is the thing I think our listeners need to know, is that she methodically waited. She made sure that legally it was sound. She met with Superintendent Karstarfin. They had a really good meeting. They talked about, you know, life beyond the deeds, like how do we continue to work together to improve the public education for our kids in the city. And so she took her time. She did it right. And it's a big win for her. And now I think that with Jason Estevez being the new school board chair, and also Ishe Collins being the vice chair, two people who have a working relationship with Mayor Bottoms, I really am proud of her, because not only was it about releasing the deeds, which she needed to do and she had promised to do. But now she did it in a way where she felt like it was very inclusive. They have a clear understanding of how they're going to work together going forward.
I think this could be an important symbolic break with the previous administration. You know, Kasim Reed came out really strong for Mayor Bottoms in the campaign. I believe that endorsement and that support helped her break away from the pack of well-qualified candidates. It could have been any number of those city council members and people with other distinguished resumes who had broken out, and Kasim really helped her in that way. I think after that endorsement, when she got into the runoff, she had to build her own identity, that she wasn't just going to be a continuation of the Reed administration, that she was her own person. And this is one bit of evidence that she is committed to continuing to tell that story, that she's her own woman, she has her own thoughts, and she's going to govern in her own way. And let me tell you that Theron mentioned my friend Jason Estevez on the Atlanta School Board. He's good people, and I think that the school board's in good hands with that guy.
We can't leave without talking about the lines at the Atlanta airport during the snowstorm. The ice that was sort of underneath that caused major problems at Hartsfield-Jackson. Brian, first of all, there were complaints from passengers, not that there were problems, but that there continue to be problems when weather attacks Hartsfield-Jackson International Airport. Now,
yeah,
there are all sorts of extenuating circumstances here. It's a big hub for one thing. Atlanta doesn't always get this sort of thing, but do storms like this, and particularly the continuing delays every time there is one, hurt the city's ability to project this image of a city where we get things done?
Well, I don't know why Hartsfield-Jackson should be different than any other mode of transportation in the city, all of which come to a screeching halt whenever we have winter precipitation. We obviously have problems that have to do with the fact that this doesn't happen enough for us to buy a lot of infrastructure, such as snow plows. We are doing things that are cheaper. We're investing in brine and salt and doing a good job of getting that stuff out on our roadways. And I think MARTA has done a fairly good job. They've had some delays, but they've been able to run throughout this. The problems at Hartsfield-Jackson, I think, go beyond the weather. You can show up there on Monday at 11 a.m. with perfectly blue skies and 70-degree temperatures and be in a line for 45 minutes for no reason whatsoever, it seems. And you can go get in a long line, and then the people behind you get roped off and sent off to a short line for no reason whatsoever. And you talk about seeing people's heads blow off. That happened to me on the way to Pasadena to see my dogs win the Rose Bowl.
I was about to say, I think there's a personal story here.
But let's be factual, okay?
That's all factual.
No, but I think we got it.
Let me finish. The thing with Hartsfield-Jackson is that every other major airport I go to, and I go to a lot less than Theron because he's a very high-paid consultant who gets flown around, so he sees a lot more of this up close and personal than I do. And when I go to other cities, I go through TSA at the terminal, and so it's a much smaller group. In Atlanta, all of you are herded through basically some bottlenecks to get to all of the terminals, and it's a really slow process.
Yeah, but back when Hartsfield-Jackson was built, we didn't have TSA lines. You know, it was a different time, and the streamlined design of being able to get to any concourse anywhere instead of having to be bused to different terminals like you do at LaGuardia or at Logan, you know, this is kind of an unintended flip side of that.
You know, we as Americans, we become very lazy. And to be honest with you, if we want to cut down on your wait time at the airport, guess what? Get to the airport a little earlier. I mean, that's one simple solution. But here's the thing why I'm saying it's not factual. Don't blame this on the city of Atlanta like Republicans want you to think is a problem because they want to create an authority to take over the airport. Don't even blame it on Roosevelt Council, the general manager, and don't blame it on Mayor Bottoms. You know who you need to blame it on? You need to blame it on TSA. And who is in charge?
But
you didn't say that, so don't cut me off.
Yeah.
Your two U.S. senators, your Republicans, your staunch Trump loyalist, David Perdue, and then your Johnny Isaacson, who really wants to be moderate and has some common sense, but he can't because he's so afraid that if he comes out and talks against Donald Trump that he'll actually get beat. Call those people, Brian. Those are the two people that can go to the Homeland Security Committee, can go to the TSA and say, hey, can we work with Atlanta to make it more efficient? This is not the mayor's fault. This is not Roosevelt Council's fault. This is TSA, which is a federal-run organization. And our two U.S. senators, wouldn't it be great if they can go to the President of the United States and say, hey, Can you get us some funding? Can you get us more people? Can we look at some innovative ways of how we can cut down the wait time? So I'm tired of this Republican-led narrative to try to discredit what's going on at the airport because it's being run by African-American leaders in this city when they're not the problem.
Let me say it for the quadruple time today. I am so glad to hear Theron say that. I'm so glad to hear a leading Democratic voice in this state acknowledge that the federal government doesn't run things very well.
And that's it for this week's Political Breakfast. I'm Dennis O'Hare, and I've been joined today by Theron Johnson and Brian Robinson. Thanks to you both.
Thank you, Dennis.
Have a great weekend.
And you can follow Brian on Twitter at Lord Tinsdale. That's Tinsdale with an N. You can follow Theron on Twitter at Theron Johnson, T-H-A-R-O-N. And you can follow me at D-E-N-I-S-O-H-A-Y-E-R. Thanks to our producer, Sam Whitehead. Now, if you like this show, please subscribe and rate us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. It really helps other people find us. And we'll be back in your feed and in your head soon with some nourishing political conversation. You've got an open invitation to join us.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Local, state, national politics. WABE and NPR have the coverage you need. I'm Jim Burris, host of WABE's All Things Considered. Whether it's on the air at 90.1, streaming online, or connecting through our mobile app, WABE keeps you on top of election 2024 in what's sure to be a pivotal year in politics. And for candidates and ballot information, visit our election hub at wabe.org/election2024.